Welcome to the July podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinchem. The July issue is on advances in brain-computer interfaces. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Parag Patil of the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Michigan speaks with Dr. Eric Luthart of the Departments of Neurological Surgery and Biomedical Engineering at Washington University. Dr. Luthart's article, Evolution of Brain-Computer Interfaces, Going Beyond Classic Motor Physiology, appears in this month's issue.
Thank you very much for your submissions and your wonderful review and article on your work. I wanted to ask you, could you tell me a little bit about your training and how you came to be interested in this area of research?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to both submit my manuscripts as well as the opportunity to speak here. So I think what got me interested in neuroprosthetics a while ago was I remember as an intern reading a Scientific American journal article about some of the earliest experiments that had been done in monkeys with neuroprosthetics, where they had implanted microarrays and were just initiating some basic levels of motor-derived control of a robotic arm. And I remember thinking at that time that, boy, this is the next stage for neurosurgery, where we were going to transition from the potential of what I at that time called ablative therapy, where we were taking out tumors, clipping aneurysms, taking out discs, to having the potential to pursue restorative approaches where we could start putting function back. And so that really led me down the path of seeking out neural engineers at Washington University when I was a resident and being fortunate enough to meet a superb neural engineer, Dan Moran, who at that time was doing research in single unit activity in primary motor cortex in macaque monkeys. And kind of out of the conversation that we had and thinking about research projects, it was at that time that Dan and I really both thought that it potentially an exciting new model for studying BCI was in these invasively monitored epilepsy patients. We could start to perform studies in humans. It was getting an invasive cortical physiology, which gave us some unique opportunities, looking at different frequencies, and it had never been done before. And so that's really what got me started, both from an interest and scientific standpoint, as well as my research.
When you were applying into neurosurgery, was functional an area of interest of yours, or did that develop during your intern year?
Yeah, it was. And I think that I've always been interested in the future of neuroscience and the future of neurosurgery, and I, at that time, thought that neuromodulation was such a large and growing area. And then I think once I started learning about neuroprosthetics, I saw that as a natural extension of functional neurosurgery.
Did you have an engineering background?
No, not at all, actually. My background, I got a degree in biology, and I actually got a degree in theology. And I remember thinking, boy, this brain-computer interface stuff
is like Deus Ex Machina.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. But when I first started getting interested, I met with the chairman of biomedical engineering, and he sat down with me and he said, so you haven't had an engineering course before? You studied theology? Why don't we put you with this new faculty, Dan Moran? At that time, I think he was kind of skeptical, but I really put my nose to the grindstone during my research time, learned how to build an amplifier, learned signal analysis, learned MATLAB programming, picked up the skills as I needed to go along so that I could start to apply some engineering principles to some of the neuroscientific and neurosurgical problems that we were having.
So you mentioned brain-computer interfaces, and other places people talk about brain-machine interfaces. Is there a difference between those two things?
Not really. I think they are linguistic derivatives of probably different kind of cultural movements within the neuroprosthetic research community. I think BCIs, or brain-computer interface, has been a term that's been used in common parlance for the groups that are coming out of the Wadsworth Center, University of Pittsburgh group, our group, whereas I think BMI, brain-machine interface, have been the term that has been used coming more out of the Duke group, but I think that they are, in essence, synonymous.
So there are a couple of different technologies that people have been using. You're using ECOG, and other people use cortical probes. Here at the University of Michigan, we have some cortical probes and so on, and I was wondering how your interest developed in the use of the ECOG probe and how you came to choose the particular small array that you describe in your paper.
So when the BCI research was really beginning and emerging in 2000, in that early phase, is that the two platforms that people were initially looking at were single-unit systems, which were beginning to show some really extraordinary levels of control with two-dimensional control, just early three-dimensional control of a robotic arm, as well as EEG, which had shown some basic control, But both those systems were derived out of basic science approaches, either neural engineering with the single unit systems and basic science with the EEG systems. But there really wasn't a strong clinical input at that time. And what I think, at least when Dan and I started to talk about it, I was beginning to understand what were some of the limitations for clinical application. Single unit systems were having problems with signal durability, meaning at that time there was a real concern that these signals would not record for longer than 6 to 12 months. And from a neurosurgical standpoint, my thought was that this was problematic, that if we were, as neurosurgeons, are going to have to be putting the electrodes in and taking them out and putting them back in repetitively, that this may not be a stable construct for true clinical application. On the flip side, when we're looking at EEG systems, it seems like there was an ultimate complexity barrier, meaning that there's a real concern of how much independent signals were you going to be able to get out of the EEG signal to get complex levels of control comparable to the single unit systems. And it was because of that that ECOG became more and more exciting to myself, Dan Moran, and a soon-to-be collaborator, Gerwin Shaw, out of the Wadsworth Center, where we thought that because the ECOG signal is being derived from under the skull, that it doesn't have the bandwidth limitations of EEG, meaning that you can see these high frequencies, these gamma rhythms. Mm-hmm. And because the electrodes are larger and don't penetrate cortex, the likelihood for longer-term signal durability was higher. And so we thought that this might be an intermediate signal platform that may have a good clinical sweet spot for real-world practical application.
I've heard that the signals are a lot larger with ECOG than with EEG. Is that true?
That is true. About an order of magnitude.
And you mentioned different frequencies that you can pick up. Could you talk to me a little bit about what the frequencies are that you can pick up with the grid that's sitting on the surface of the brain versus one, say, in the epidural space or on the surface of the skin?
Sure. So first off, I'll just give you kind of a very brief overlay of the very kind of fundamental different frequencies that we look at. In general, there are some low frequencies that you can see basically through EEG and ECOG, both. These are typically referred to as mu rhythms and beta rhythms. And these tend to be widely distributed across cortex. And again, they're low frequency, meaning that they're less than 30 hertz. And because they're low frequency and because they engage large areas of cortex, that's why you can see them on the scalp. Because the skull essentially acts as what we call a low-pass filter. It filters out the higher frequencies, frequencies above 40 hertz. Now, those higher frequencies are referred to as gamma rhythms. And when you look at the difference between these high frequencies and low frequencies, that they're really thought to represent different neurophysiologic substrates, meaning that the mu and beta rhythms, these low frequencies, are thought to represent the postsynaptic potentials, which are likely due to thalamocortical circuits. The high frequencies, the stuff that you can really only see under the skull, are thought to represent smaller cortical neural ensembles, which are acting in synchrony.
Would it be fair to say that the low-frequency signals are the cortex talking to the thalamus and the thalamus talking to the cortex, and the high-frequency are neurons that are adjacent to each other talking to each other?
Very likely. There's probably more to it than that, but I think in the broadest sweep, that's very likely what we're looking at.
I interrupted you. You were talking about the different rhythms and then how they vary between recordings on the surface and also on the skin.
That's right.
And then how you chose the particular probe that you did.
That's right. And again, because there was essentially a frequency limitation to EEG, these ECOG electrodes gave us a broader frequency for which we could interrogate. And at that time, initially, people kind of assumed that EEG and ECOG were the same, that there really wouldn't be much difference at that time between the high frequencies and the low frequencies in terms of control or amount of information that you could get out. But we were interested in these high frequencies, and we thought that there may be some potential, both in terms of improved signal to noise, improved control. But once we started putting those electrodes under the skull, that we really, I think, had a lot of surprising results in the sense that these high frequencies could get control very quickly. And as it turned out, when we looked at more complex tasks, such as moving a joystick, that we could actually get information out of that gamma rhythm signals that told us not only is cortex active, not active, but really gave us cognitive intention, very similar to information that you could derive out of single unit systems. So it was these high frequency rhythms that you can't pick up through EEG, and that's why the subdural array really became the optimal platform from our standpoint.
Do you think that you'll be able to pick up these high frequency signals from an epidural array?
It's a question we're actively pursuing, because it has very important clinical implications. So Dan Moran, my collaborator, is looking at that very question in monkeys by putting electrode arrays subdurally and epidurally. Now, we do have some preliminary evidence in humans where we've put ECOG electrodes above and below the dura, and we have seen that we can record these gamma frequencies above the dura and that we can use them for control. And we published on that, I think, in 2006.
I'm interested by your talking about patients learning how to use things quickly with the gamma frequency compared to the lower frequency. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
It's an interesting dynamic process that goes on between the computer and the user when they're achieving control by using some cognitive act. And what's interesting is that the way that we achieve control is first we screen for some cognitive action, such as a very simple example. When we want to achieve a one-dimensional control of a cursor, we basically either ask them to move their hand or we ask them to imagine moving their hand. And we look for some feature that they can potentially utilize that essentially tags that cognitive action. For instance, we record from the grid, we have them imagine moving their hand, and we see in one particular electrode over motor cortex a high frequency change. Usually it's an amplitude increase at, say, 100 hertz. And then we go back to them and we say, okay, if you want the cursor to move to the right, imagine moving your hand. And so the computer is trained to basically recognize for that particular electrode at that particular frequency an increase in amplitude, and that's essentially a cue that the individual is intending to move that cursor to the right. And what's very interesting is that with time, once they have the computer screen in front of them and they see the cursor moving back and forth, they will actually learn to tune their brain signal so that they can very focally and robustly change their amplitude at 100 hertz very quickly and very appropriately to the given target that's there.
So people have control over the 100 hertz signals in their brains?
That's exactly right. And they can do it quickly, on the order of 30 minutes. When we saw these kind of very plastic changes, it emphasized not only that we can use these gamma rhythms for control, but once you provide people with feedback regarding their brain signals, that feedback allows them to change their brain signals very quickly.
You talked about a couple of things that were exciting in the paper that you submitted. Could you tell me a little bit about the paper and what you think is most important about it?
Sure. So the review paper starts off by talking about these various platforms, EEG, ECOG, single unit system. Each of them have their advantages and disadvantages. But a lot of the research essentially has been derived out of looking at physiology associated with what I call classic motor physiology, primary motor cortex operating the contralateral side of your body. And what I think is very interesting and what we start to see emerging is that there's a number of different distinct physiologies as well as cognitive paradigms that we can potentially use for adjunct control or distinct control or ways that we can achieve a diverse manner of control in addition to or in replacement of this classic motor physiology. Some of those examples would be, for instance, the next step for a potential BCI application is that currently BCIs need to be utilized for potential patients, which would be spinal cord injury patients or neuromuscular disorders. Basically, the assumption that your motor outflow is impaired, but your brain is intact. But there's a much larger population of patients who are motor impaired who essentially have injured brains, namely through hemispheric stroke or through traumatic brain injury. And so the question is, can we use BCI techniques to augment those patients? And so the next cortical physiology that we started to examine is cortical motor physiology associated with ipsilateral limb movements. And what we found is that there is a very distinct physiology associated with ipsilateral movements, which we can distinguish from contralateral physiology, and we can also utilize for device control. So that's one area of non-classic motor physiology, physiology associated with ipsilateral movements, same-sided limb movements, that is separable, that we can use for not only potentially an adjunct to contralateral control, but also for a new patient population.
So people talk about representation in the supplementary motor cortex that is ipsilateral and contralateral. Do you think that this is something similar that you're seeing in the primary motor cortex, or is it?
No, I think it is distinct, because when we look at the anatomic location, again, this is looking at data we see from grid, so we don't often go interhemispheric, but I think that they are complementary findings, is that more of what we see in terms of cortical physiology, in terms of anatomic localization for ipsilateral signals, tend to be premotor. They occur before the movement onset, and they occur at a different frequency. And again, a lot of these findings are supporting the fact that the ipsilateral representation is more involved with motor planning, similar to the supplemental motor area, which is involved with motor planning, which is bihemispherically represented, versus the execution, which is more unilaterally represented and contralateral.
You talked about mutual information, which is, of course, a measure of the entropy between two signals as your way of correlating signals in the EMG to ECOG.
That's right.
I was wondering, can you tell from that whether a signal is responding to another signal, or whether it's just correlated with it, or whether maybe it's a proprioceptive kind of signal?
It's a great question. I think that certainly more work needs to be done. I think this was a first foray in the second paper that we wrote, in looking at mutual information between brain signals and EMG from a very small microgrid. The point of that was to show that, again, I don't know whether the signal's causative, meaning the cortex is driving that EMG signal, or is it responsive? Likely, I think it's causative because it's coming out of primary motor cortex versus sensory motor cortex. But the point of that is telling us that we can determine a substantial amount of information from motor kinematics, which is derived from that EMG, from a very small region of cortex. So that from a 4 millimeter by 4 millimeter grid array, that we could determine whether somebody was flexing or extending their wrist, and we could know whether that was the ipsilateral or contralateral side. And what I think is very interesting about that is that we don't need the classic 8 centimeter by 8 centimeter grids to get out substantial information about cognitive intentions, but we can do it through a very small area of cortex.
So it sounds like this technology might allow you to make BCI devices that are a lot less invasive, maybe, than ones in the past have been.
That's exactly right. What I would imagine and what I hope for is that we can envision a BCI implant that really only requires a burr hole over some critical sites, such as potentially motor areas or potentially speech areas, and could also potentially be epidural, so that one could imagine a very minimally invasive, well-tolerated procedure that would really require maybe a brief and easy-to-apply procedure by the surgeon, and it would allow the patient to be potentially discharged the following day.
The study that you did was in an epilepsy patient. Do you
That's
think
right.
the fact that that patient had epilepsy made a difference in what you found?
I don't think so. Number one is that these are patients who have focal partial epilepsy, and the areas that we are studying getting information out of are areas not involved with the epilepsy focus. And number two is that usually when we see abnormal signals such as ictal signals or seizures, that they tend to involve the entire areas of cortex. Where we're deriving information tends to be from small and focal areas.
Did the patients benefit in any way, or what were the kind of regulatory and IRB kinds of hurdles that you had to go through to do this kind of research at your institution?
Well, certainly it requires human studies approval. And the one thing that I tell patients is that this will not increase or decrease the quality or nature of their clinical care from an epilepsy standpoint. I think the benefit that they potentially get is that they are basically participating in scientific research that can stand to improve both epilepsy and motor impaired patients in the future. I think the real world benefit that they get is that while they're being monitored, they have to sit in bed for 1 to 2 weeks, and that they have actually the benefit of getting to do something. It helps fight boredom.
So instead of watching TV, they get to play a video game.
That's exactly right.
When eventually you can apply this technology in patients who have strokes or handicaps, I guess their brains might be a little bit different than the epilepsy patients because, for example, a patient who has an amputation may not have the same signals coming into their brain as a patient who doesn't. I was wondering, do you have any evidence about that, or is that something that you've considered in designing your device?
That's a great question. Certain populations may be better suited for brain-computer interfaces than others. So, for instance, ALS patients, I get worried about that there is, for instance, a known documented loss, that there are motor neuron loss over time in ALS in cortex. Additionally, I think with the prolonged chronic patients who have lost motor function over a long, long period of time, that their brain signals may not be as robust in doing imagined motor activity, just because they haven't done it in a long time.
Are the signals that you get from imagined activity the same as the signals that you get from actual movement?
Very, very similar. There are several publications now that show that whether you see it, or excuse me, whether you imagine it, whether you do it, or even whether you see it, that it creates very similar cortical signals.
How long do you think it'll be until neurosurgeons are putting in ECOG-based neuroprosthetic devices?
My hope would be within 5 to 10 years.
And what do you think are the things that we need to figure out between now and then?
Well, I think we're reasonably close. I think that one major component, which I think is important from a FDA regulatory standpoint, whether we can or cannot implant these, is the durability of recording. And that's actually, again, something I think research that is ongoing, where Dan Morana, as well as others, are putting epidural and subdural electrode arrays to see what the chronicity of signal recording is. I think we need to advance the level of complexity of control that we can achieve. I think right now the standard is that we can achieve two-dimensional control in human subjects fairly quickly and fairly reliably. But I think for it to be of functional benefit, we need at least 3 degrees of freedom, which would be either controlling the cursor on a screen with the ability to click, kind of like a mouse that we can use today, or to operate in three-dimensional space. Because I think the first users are going to be patients with severe motor disability, quadriplegic spinal cord injury patients, and this could potentially facilitate their ability to navigate an operating system, which I think could enhance their ability to communicate their need and communicate in general.
I'm sure that you're familiar with the work that was done by the Brown Group in which a ray was placed in the cortex and a patient performed tasks. Do you think that similar kinds of tasks can be done today with the ECOG technology?
Yeah, I do, absolutely.
So you're a neurosurgeon, you're a theologian, and you're a scientist. And one thing that we're often asked is, how do you manage to do two or three things? I'm sure that you're involved in teaching residents as well, running a lab and so on. How do you divide up your time, and what advice could you give to residents and fellows who are interested in following in your footsteps?
Sure. To describe my job, I actually wear three hats. I have a lab where I have about 5 graduate students, either in biomedical engineering or computer science. I have a clinical practice where I'm taking care of primarily epilepsy patients, patients with brain tumors, or occasionally also some patients with spinal pathology. And my third hat actually is I actually run a center called the Center for Innovation in Neuroscience and Technology to build cross-disciplinary efforts between neurosurgery and engineering. I would say 50% clinical and 50% either research or center-related activities. And as far as advice, I think, to residents and people in their early years, is that one thing I found was key was in the first 6 months of starting my academic practice, was to really, really work and create a concerted effort to have a functioning lab very early on. Because in part, one of the things that I found was that you will always get busier with clinical activity. And I think the natural inclination is once you get done as a neurosurgery resident, you know, I want to use my skills. I want to become a busy neurosurgeon as soon as possible. But I think one of the things is that when you first start off, you're going to become a busy neurosurgeon regardless of what you do, just because there's a real need for neurosurgical care. And whereas you never get the time like you have in the first 6 months to really have a concerted focal effort to building an infrastructure and a manpower and an effort so that you can successfully manage a lab in the future. As you go further along, it becomes harder and harder to micromanage and really do all the detail-related stuff of the day-to-day lab management as you become a busier practicing neurosurgeon. So I think one of the things that I think is really important I tell a lot of the guys coming through here at Washington University is make sure that you really utilize that early time effectively for infrastructure development of your lab. From a resident standpoint, there's a lot of talk, and people often ask me, do I need to get a PhD to do this type of stuff? And I would say I don't think you need to, because in part, with an MD-PhD, I think there's several issues. Certainly, MD-PhDs are superbly trained. It's an excellent scientific and medical background. The hard part, however, is that sometimes with residency, it puts those research skills on hold for 6 to 7 to 8 years, potentially. And so the one thing that I found for me is that, you know, I did my research fellowship here at WashU, is that I really immersed myself in that research, and then I maintained that research effort even during the clinical portion of my residency so that I could hit the ground running once I started my practice. And so I think that you can do basic science research. I think you can do effective, whether it be basic science translational research as a faculty member without that PhD. And I think the key is really just maintaining some level of connection through your residency so that it's just not an isolated focus, that it's not just 2 years and then you come back to it 4 years later, but actually in some way try to stay connected to it, even if it's just a few hours a week. I think that really keeps your mind in the game so that you can really be more effective when you start an academic neurosurgeon.
I have a 50-50 split, too.
Uh-huh.
Boy, I tell you, keeping both things going has been pretty challenging, and the clinical stuff for me just exploded.
I was lucky in that, you know, again, I wasn't that busy when I started off. And somebody gave me that advice, actually. Don't worry about the clinical practice. It's going to build itself. Focus on whatever it is that you want to focus on outside of clinical neurosurgery. So if you want to do research, do that hardcore until, you know, your clinical practice is going to force its way in. And so there's a couple things that I was lucky also. Dan Moran is a great friend and a colleague, and he really helped me when I first started off. And I had a graduate student right when I started. So, you know, I poured a lot of effort into him and made him happy, and so that when more graduate students came on, there was a resident expert outside of myself to train those people as well.
Right.
And so, again, now I've got pretty kind of self-sustaining lab, and I've got 5 graduate students, multiple medical students taking years off, and so that I don't have to micromanage details of the lab. And also, mine's not a wet lab, which also helps a lot. But I think one thing that I really like about my research and that has made it successful is that my clinical practice directly serves my research practice. When I do invasive monitoring, I'm generating data for my lab. So that I'm capitalizing on the unique opportunity of being a neurosurgeon to get data that nobody else can get to. Because we as neurosurgeons have a unique access to the human central nervous system that nobody else does. And if you can capitalize on that, it allows you to be a gatekeeper. So that, for instance, I can collaborate with a lot of people, and I'm still very involved in the research by giving them data that they can't get.
I think that's absolutely critical. The clinical question and the research question almost have to be the same question,
yeah.
Very overlapping.
And that's where I think neurosurgeons as neuroscientists can play a central and pivotal role, because whether it be getting access to human brain tumors from genetic analysis, whether it be access to spinal fluid in humans on a regular basis to cortical signals, and in my mind, not doing something is essentially a waste of an unbelievable informational resource. You know, when I first started doing this ECOG stuff, I realized like they were just deleting all this basically acquired data like every week to replace with new amount. I was like, my God, here we have invasive human cortical physiology, and they're getting rid of it. Figure out a way to make your clinical practice generate data, whether it be tumors, spine, biomechanics, whatever. Figure out some way that that's generating data, because what all the neuroscientists are doing is trying to answer questions fundamentally about like how our brains work. And we have the best access to human brains better than anybody, or spines, you know, for that matter. And so if we could figure out some way kind of utilize our access to the nervous system to generate information about that, that gives us a competitive, unique role, because where I can't compete against a guy doing mouse studies.
Right.
Just because I don't have time, but I can compete by generating information about the human nervous system, which the neuroscientific community is fundamentally interested in.
Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much. Again, it's a real privilege to talk, and thank you for the opportunity to write about some of this stuff in Neurosurgical Focus.
This concludes our podcast for the July issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the August issue, when the topic will be surgery of limbic and paralimbic gliomas. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.